Well, now it's your turn. We welcome your questions. I would ask you please to stand and wait for the microphone so we all can hear what you have to say. Please stand up and identify yourselves and state whether your question is directed to a particular panelist. And please keep your questions concise so we'll have more time to entertain more of them. Let's start right back there with Dr. Cosman.
Regarding the economics of medical care, please remind us what Milton Friedman had to contribute to that issue. Maybe you want to start with Paul?
Well, I think he understood, obviously, the many problems with the third-party payments and the fact that medical care ought to be allocated based upon market principles, just like all other services and products in a free society. So I think he would, if he were alive today, looking at President Bush's policy, for example, he would recent proposal. He would say that it's moving in the right direction to start to level the playing field on the tax treatment of health care, for example. Ultimately, he would support that kind of a move, whether, of course, being Milton Friedman, he would be happy if it were a big bang right away. But even a gradual change, I think he would support in the movement of more consumer-driven, individual judgments about how you spend your health care dollars and the kinds of treatment you get.
Let's see. Right over here.
How long...
Can you stand up, please?
Yes,
state
sorry.
Your name. Tell us who you are, please.
How many years do you think it will go by until there is broad-based support and many, many, many families all over the country taking advantage of vouchers, and what's going to precipitate that change? Would it be suburban schools starting to fail, and then there's no one's having a good time?
And tell us who you are, please.
Walter Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Riley.
I tried to lay out my answer. I think technology is going to help us enormously on that front. I think it's very difficult to beat in a frontal assault an interest group that is so dug in as a teacher's in what is fundamentally a risk-averse society when it comes to parents dealing with their children. They don't want to take really high-risk, endorse high-risk policy change. So I think it's going to have to be incremental. And how many years? I don't know.
One thing that has to happen, I think, is for suburban parents to recognize that their public schools really are not very good. American students place 10th to 20th on international tests of reading and mathematics and so forth, where the spending per student is typically twice that in places like Ireland and Finland, where they're doing much better than here in the United States. Now, I don't know what's going to force that recognition. I agree with Paul that technology is going to be an end run about this, because I think you can have a lot of schooling online these days with very much more freedom of choice and possibility of getting much, much better schooling. There is a good experiment on that underway already in Arizona.
Steve Savas, City University of New York, for Dr. Pineda. I understand that recently some reports have emerged that there are some problems have emerged with respect to the privatized Social Security system in Chile, and the left in the United States has seized upon that as saying, see, it doesn't work. Could you elaborate and enlighten us about that, please?
Of course. There are no problem whatsoever, sir. the problem is the editorial page of the New York Times, but that is another problem.
Always a problem.
We just celebrated 26 years of the private account system. In 26 years, not a peso has been lost to mismanagement, fraud, or anything. The rate of return of the funds, the annual one, has been 10.1% above inflation for 26 years. If that is a problem, well, maybe, but I don't think so. So the system is completely successful, so much so that we have in Chile now a new president, a charismatic lady, a youthful follower of Che Guevara, and yet she decided to keep intact the private account system. And what she proposed, and it's a legitimate thing, is to use the enormous budget surpluses that we are having in Chile. Last year, 8.4% of GNP, of budget surplus, to increase the safety net. Because we have a private account, and for the very poor, the unemployed, the informal worker, we have a safety net. So she has proposed to increase the safety net, something that is debatable and is perfectly reasonable. There are some problems with incentives and so on, but that is a second derivative. The private account system is totally successful, so much so that we have been able to export it to 31 countries in the world. Today, 125 million workers have a Chilean-type personal account system. So all those countries will not be following if they were reading the New York Times. You should read the Wall Street Journal, sir.
By the way, on that point, I would think, I would guess that a country that before too long will come to think that this personal account system will work very well for them is China. I don't think they'll go for a Social Security kind of retirement system. They obviously need some kind of – they need their population to build up assets. And I think they will find – I bet they will turn to the Chilean model. And when they do, that might even have an effect on Congress. Well, maybe not, but we can hope.
And don't go too far now. Sir?
My name is Barry Milliken. My question is – if Mr. Friedman were here today debating the current chairman of the Federal Reserve, how would they disagree?
I think not much. Friedman was not specifically an advocate of an inflation rule, inflation targeting. He was not an advocate of inflation targeting. Bernanke, I think, has backed away from a strict interpretation of the idea. I think Bernanke has learned correctly that he has to restrict his public comments to matters over which the Federal Reserve has some responsibility. Unfortunately, I think that that was not true of Alan Greenspan in his later years in the job, because he got involved in too many issues and became regarded by Congress in many cases as a spokesman for the Republican administration, which I think was quite an unfortunate situation. And I think Bernanke has done a very good job in terms of his actual policy since coming to office a year ago, and he's much more careful about his public remarks than was the case at the time.
Let's see, we have a question in back here, please.
Alex Lubarsky, Health Media Group. My question is to Mr. Piñera. Having reformed the pension plans around the world using Mr. Friedman's ideas, I wanted to ask you your perspective of American healthcare and what possibilities it has by having these market approaches towards it from your perspective.
Well, I'm not an expert on America's health system, but I have always thought that by going to a personal retirement account in Social Security, that is honestly easy to explain if you have a good communicator in the government, of course, that you needed. You had a Minister of Social Security that regrettably was not in the government in the last years, even though I admire the courage of the President to mention personal accounts in the State of the Union of 2005. But my view is that if you move to personal accounts in Social Security and then you change the way people think about incentives, about savings, you will have an enormous impetus to reform then health on the line of enlarged medical savings accounts and so on. That's what we did in my country. We did first old age, then health, and now we even have unemployment accounts. That is, instead of having a subsidy, we encourage workers to save in some account that are called unemployment, and therefore, when you are unemployed, you can withdraw some money from the account. And if you are never unemployed, that mixes with the retirement and so on. So this is a paradigm change. You see, once you give people the idea that you are not entitled to all sort of government benefits, but that you have to save, to be responsible, to rely on your responsibility with a safety net, then people begin to think different in many other areas of social policy.
I think that's a good general rule. Now, the two institutions that have worked on this matter, I think, longest are the National Center for Policy Analysis in Dallas and the Cato Institute. And we have come to a more or less of a consensus on this issue about the steps that need to be taken. One is insurance is a very large part of the problem. Broadening insurance is not part of the solution. People ought to be able to buy any kind of insurance they want, but we ought to restrict any governmentally subsidized insurance to high deductible policies, where the deductible may be a function of income or of age, something of that nature. But all kinds of things, healthcare is a much bigger problem and a much more complicated problem than Social Security. We ought to go ahead and sort out Social Security. It's a much easier problem to address. But any number of things need to be done in healthcare. We need to change any government-provided health insurance from a defined benefit program to a defined contribution program. As long as it's a defined benefit program, there's always going to be some kind of medical care that's not listed, not covered. And that provides an incentive for broadening the system. I think we need to take it off of the employers. We have employer-provided health insurance by historical accident in the United States. You don't get your life insurance or your fire insurance or your auto insurance through employer. You get your health insurance through your employer because of, believe it or not, wage and price controls during World War II. And Kaiser, then building big ships, recruited labor by offering them a health plan, which was not covered by the wage controls. We need to get it away from the employer so that we buy our health insurance the way that we buy any other kind of insurance. I think we have to allow individuals to buy insurance for companies that are not chartered in their state. We ought to create a national market for health insurance, so you're not restricted to the options that are offered in your own state. I think that if we end up with a publicly financed health insurance system that has, say, an income-tested and maybe an age-tested deductible, but it is not a defined benefit program, it's a defined contribution program, does not in any way specify what individuals might choose themselves given that particular set of rules, that I think is where we ought to end up. In that case, the only political decision is sort of the rules for the deductible. The rules for the deductible. And all of the other decisions are made by the patient and the physician. And that's where we ought to end up. Now, that's the direction in which we ought to be going. I think in many cases we can do this step by step, piecemeal. It doesn't have to be all done at once. But the President's proposal of the State of the Union message, I think, was unusually creative. It was limited, but it was unusually created, and it deserves support. It deserves understanding first and then support.
We've got about 10 minutes, so if we keep the questions and the answers very concise, we'll squeeze as many in as we can. Right over here.
J.P. Donlan, Chief Executive Magazine. This question is not just for the panel, but anyone in the room for that matter. And the next generation, who would you say has picked up the Friedmanite torch among the sort of intellectual community? Who should we be paying attention to?
Let the market decide that.
I think you're probably best to ask that question of an active professor, because they see the young people who are coming up, whereas I don't see them unless they're applying for a job. And one of the more encouraging developments in economics is that a lot of schools, which were not very long ago dominated by Keynesians, are now quite Friedmanite, including Harvard, by the way. So I think that there's much better average quality of education in the economics departments now than was the case 20, 30 years ago.
I would just add that one of the, I mean, I agree with Bill about that, and there's no longer so few of them like Milton Friedman that you have to say, you can say that there's one or two or three. There's a whole multitude of younger economists who are doing interesting research. I mean, Kevin Murphy at the University of Chicago, for example, on school choice at Harvard, I think her name is Carolyn Hoxby. She's done some very interesting work looking at the impact of school choice. And there's just a lot of them out there. I mean, a lot of them send in op-eds to us. There's a couple of economists at Dartmouth doing good work on free trade. So there are many more, and I think that's very, very encouraging. The paradigm, intellectual paradigm in economics has changed so fundamentally that, I mean, even Paul Krugman used to be a free trader when he was an academic before he became a columnist.
I would add briefly that places you now will find the future Milton Friedmans of the world would not be just at universities, as you've heard, but Milton Friedman did a lot of his excellent work at the Hoover Institution as a think tank scholar. And I would look to the think tanks in the United States, like the Manhattan Institute, like Cato, like the Heritage Foundation. I work with the Atlas Economic Research Foundation. We work with or support about 250 free market think tanks in about 75 countries around the world. And there we work with the Milton Friedman of Bangladesh or the Milton Friedman of Nigeria or what have you. And so there are people around the world who are advancing these ideas and helping people become free to choose in those places around the world. So I think that's another place I'd look for the future Milton Friedmans of the world. Question here.
Hi, Don Smith. Did Friedman ever give any guidelines on when the United States should intervene militarily abroad?
Not to my knowledge. He was a very strong and effective advocate for ending conscription, but to my knowledge, he never made public remarks about how big an army or navy or air force and marines we ought to have and what they should do. Pardon?
He didn't have a position on Vietnam at the time.
I don't know that he ever took a public position on Vietnam.
When he came to see us at the editorial board a year or so ago, he did talk about the threat from Islamic, from Islamists, and their ability to get a nuclear weapon or a weapon of mass destruction as the foremost threat of our time. But I don't recall him having very strong views about how to deal with it, particularly as relates to the Bush Doctrine or something like that.
We have time for just a couple more questions. Let's go to the back of the room here.
Hello, I'm Charlotte Frank. I just want to say, back in the 1950s, Life magazine put out a full issue on the problems in education, which has continued. And it's really a wonderful document if you ever want to take a look at it. I guess my question is to our speakers. Most of us have taken off a full morning, sometime part of the afternoon. What would you like us to do about education? We talk about vouchers. If I just change the words to free choice, just know that one-third of our students don't graduate from high school. One-third of our students who then go on to college leave. I mean, we've got 2,000 high schools in which we have kids locked in there, and they are, we know that they are underperformers. What would you want to have happen? What should we do to start to deal with that situation?
Well, the common word behind all the changes that are being made is choice by parents. I think choice within the public school system itself is desirable. The charter school movement should not be dismissed. I think it provides choice within given school districts. Choice between public and private schools, one way or the other, whether it's by a voucher or a credit, I think should be at the top of the list. I think in many cases, however, we need to, within the public school system, reverse the two major changes that have been made over my adult lifetime. When I started high school, there were 140,000 school districts in this country. There are now about 14,000. So the school districts have enormously magnified in terms of the number of students that they handle. And that centralization has been counterproductive to student performance. Second is that when I started high school, almost all school finance came from the local district, was financed out of the property taxes. Now the dominant financing agent for schools is the state, with an unfortunately increasing role by the federal government. So we need to decentralize the choice of where to go to school to the parents and decentralize the choice about what kind of school will be provided and where to the level of the local school districts. And to do that, I think we need to reverse these two major changes in American public schooling over the past 60 years.
We have time for one more question. This gentleman here in the hot cocoa-colored jacket. And as he awaits the microphone, I would remind you, please, when we break for lunch, if you wouldn't mind, please clearing your tables of all your papers and notes so that the staff can serve us lunch. Sir, you get our last question, please.
I'm Ken Silber. I'm wondering if anyone on the panel could address the complaints sometimes heard from harder-line libertarians that Friedman allowed too much scope for government action with his ideas about school vouchers or negative income tax or his role in setting up income tax withholding.
I'm sorry, he allowed too much what?
Allowed too much role for government.
Too big a role for the government. Did Milton Friedman provide too big a role for government? Interesting, provocative final question.
Friedman wanted to work on the edge of what was feasible and to make the best case possible for moving the feasible in the direction of freedom, individual liberty. I think that he typically despaired about utopianism, libertarian or otherwise. I think he was embarrassed about the fact that the first policy issue to which he worked on was income tax withholding during World War II, working for a man who was later proved to be a communist agent. He wanted to pull the edge of what is feasible in the direction of individual liberty, and I think he recognized that to do that you don't want to adopt anybody's model of utopia, libertarian or otherwise.
Jose, go ahead.
Briefly, I totally agree with Bill, and I incidentally discussed this once with Milton at length at his apartment, because in our reform, of course, we allow the worker to take the full FICA tax to a personal retirement account. So that is a huge step toward choice and freedom, but it's not all the way. All the way will be to tell people you can do whatever you want with your FICA tax, but that is completely impossible. I have been in 80 countries in the world. You cannot even begin saying you should go from 60 years of Social Security given by the government to complete zero, even because people believe that the government has some role. So what we did in Chile was to go to private account, but, and I told this to Milton and he loved it, in a little article, I put that the compulsory, the mandatory account goes only up to a certain level of income. That in Chile is incidentally $25,000 a year. So you have to put 10% of $25,000. So if you make $100,000, you put much less than $10,000. Now, since we did this 25 years ago, the income per capita of Chile has gone up three times, but the ceiling has not been touched in 25 years. So the mandatory element has been going down enormously, but in an automatic pilot. Now, I don't emphasize this very much in Chile because someone will realize it and then will be trying to raise the ceiling. But to libertarian groups, I tell them we are moving toward a totally free social security system, but through the process, you see. So the day will come when every Chilean makes $100,000 a year, and they will only have to put 10% of 25, so 2,500, that is 2.5%, you see? So that is the way change is affected. I don't have much time to libertarians who say, why don't you simply eliminate Social Security? Well, you last only 1 second proposing that to any prime minister of the world. But if you propose changing the system to personal retirement accounts, you have moved already 90% of the road. And then you can move the other 10 in time through intelligent, well-designed mechanism like the one I'm explaining. And I remember that Milton liked it enormously, you see, this process.
I don't have much patience either with those who say that the government, that vouchers would allow the government to start to infiltrate, take over private schools. Private schools would still have the capacity to resist that money if they wanted to. Meanwhile, what is it, 78 or 80% of the kids are in public schools. And to say that we don't want to worry about them because we're worried about what government might do to this or that private school, I think, is irresponsible. And Friedman operated at the nexus of ideas and politics, and when you do that, you have to make some accommodation for what is achievable. And as he said in his essay on education, there are neighborhood effects. There are there is some public good for making sure that everybody has a public education. And so within that framework, vouchers seem to me to be about as libertarian an idea as is practically achievable.
Well, thank you all for your questions and comments. Please join me once again in thanking our panelists, William Niskanen, Jose Pinera, and Paul Gigard.